Today, Psalm 93.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
This is an interesting kind of fun psalm to do because it's brief. It's a very short psalm, and its message is pretty straightforward. And when I say that, I don't mean it's just something glib that's unimportant. It's actually pretty profound, in fact, remarkably profound, and thematic through the rest of Scripture. And I think it's something, what makes it most interesting to me is I think it's something in just reading through the psalm once, we probably wouldn't notice. And that prompts me to say, before I start into this fairly short psalm, something about how I read Scripture altogether and how I understand teaching Scripture. It's not like I think it requires some magic key or secret understanding to grasp the great hidden truths of Scripture that only a scholar can understand. You know, it's not, I don't think that at all. These psalms are written for a congregation to show up and sing together and realize the experience of hearing these words in that context. That's not a person sitting down and explaining the details of it. It's not, you know, in the old joke, if the scriptures had been written in English, what would our preachers even do? Because I got to explain to you what the Hebrew is and what the Greek is in the New Testament and so on. It's not that at all. It's not that there's some magical understanding that you have to obtain. The difference is, and it's the same way I teach literature to people, you experience the power of literature because you just read it. The whole point of a good author is that they confront you with things, whether you understand them or not, that you needed to be confronted with, or that in the confrontation or in the experience of them, elicits or evokes responses in you that are automatic, and they're built into the literature itself. You don't have to understand it. That's not the point of this. The point of this, and because the scriptures are written the way they are by a God who understands humans and the ones who are going to sing it, blah, 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 if you sing the psalms together, of course you're going to experience the things that they are. The thing that makes, you know, these explanations, this work on hermeneutics and all the exposition that we do about it worthwhile is that it gives us a better understanding of why it affects us the way it does and of why the transitions in the text, for instance, take place, or hopefully the ones that take place in us do so. So that's how I approach these things. That's how I'm coming at this psalm as well. And it's really great because it is so similar in some ways to other psalms, these elements of the creation that are brought out in it, and the obvious references to the power and sovereignty of God. But there is a little turn in it. It's not completely unique to this psalm, but it's uniquely presented in this psalm. And so we'll see that at the very end of the psalm. So starting, first of all, just with a reading of the psalm itself, starting in verse 1, the Lord reigns. There is no superscript, by the way, in this psalm. The Lord reigns. He's robed in majesty. The Lord is robed. He has put on strength as his belt. Yes, the world is established. It shall never be moved. Your throne is established from of old. You are from everlasting. The floods have lifted up, O Lord. The floods have lifted up their voice. The floods lift up their roaring. Mightier than the thunders of many waters, mightier than the waves of the sea, the Lord on high is mighty. And then verse 5, the last verse of the psalm. Your decrees are very trustworthy. Holiness befits your house, O Lord, forevermore. That's a, good short psalm, you hear me? 5 verses. And so you're thinking, okay, well, 10-minute episode, right? Maybe. I don't know. We'll see. We'll just see how it goes. But I will say this. It does seem very, you know, fairly clearly put into three parts. The first part, this declaration about Yahweh's reign. The Lord in this passage is, you know, in the English, all capitals, it's Yahweh that's being described. So it's this covenantal God. Yahweh, the Lord, reigns. He is robed in majesty. The Lord is robed. He has put on strength as his belt. Yes, there's a description of the world as well. So it's Yahweh's reign and his majesty, strength, and permanence. And that's painted in the context of the world, the creation, as the evidence of his permanence. So the second half of verse 1 is, yes, the world is established. It shall never be moved. But then verse 2 is a follow-up on these statements about Yahweh. Your throne is established from of old. You are from everlasting. So the opening to the psalm is just this declaration about Yahweh and the world and his throne and all of the things that are associated with that. And we'll come back to that. The second part of the psalm, verses 3 and 4, has this focus on the waves of the sea, most likely references to the seas, and, you know, whether that's the Mediterranean or both, by the way, the Mediterranean or the Sea of Galilee, or just these larger bodies of water and the waves crashing on the shore from these bodies of water. That's the idea. And of course, we would think of that more in oceanic terms. So maybe the Mediterranean or something like that for them. Anyway, the idea is in verse 3, the floods have lifted up. So it starts with a statement about the waves and the water. And so it's all about the created order and the things that are there. But it does end with the statement, the Lord on high is mighty. So a reversion to what was going on in the first couple of verses, right? So the Lord on high is mighty. And in some way, that sets a contrast with what's been described about the waves, or maybe a fulfillment of what their image was supposed to evoke in us about God. We'll come back to it. And then in verse 5, there's a complete shift. Your decrees are very trustworthy. It's almost like the shifts that you find in Psalm 19, you know, where you're talking about God and the creation for 6 verses, and then you leave that behind entirely and talk only about Scripture. It's a really strong shift, and this shift is very similar. Your decrees are very trustworthy. And then holiness, not strength, not permanence, not power, holiness befits your house, O Lord. And then we add on forevermore. So it is eternal. There's something that reminds us of the eternality of God in this final statement in verse 5. So I'm going to take those three elements. If we took 1 through 4 together, we would end up making a very similar point. But I think it works this way, that when we're interacting with the words of this psalm, we're thinking in the first couple of verses about the strong relationship between Yahweh's reign and majesty and strength and permanence and the way we encounter his creation, which appears to have that same those same characteristics of majesty and strength and permanence. And so that's how it's described. So starting in verse 1 again, the Lord reigns. He's robed in majesty. The Lord, and this is a repetition for the sake of emphasis, the Lord is robed. He has put on strength as his belt. And so, yeah, he's put on this, he's girded himself with this evidence of his power, his strength. And so the second half of it is, you know, part of what he appears to have girded himself with, which is the creation itself. So he puts it out there and it demonstrates the power that he has, but it also demonstrates to us the sense that there's something more powerful than we are. So, yes, the world is established. It shall never be moved. I know. You think to yourself, well, that's not true. I mean, after all, the world's only going to be here for a few billion more years before it dissolves or whatever it is. And after all, there are earthquakes and so on like that. But in the point is that for us and in reality, as we experience the world, it is this unmovable object. It is this thing that will still be here when we're long gone. It is the thing that after we have dissolved into it, exists in such a way as if we had never even been here. So the world is established and it will never be moved in comparison with us. Your throne, then it goes on in verse 2 to say about Yahweh, is established from of old. Now that's, you know, I mean, that again, that makes us go, well, wait a minute, I thought he was eternal, and why would there be an establishment of a throne? in reference to who we are. If, you know, whatever, if we think of God having a beginning, it was established from long before we were, and we wouldn't have any way of comparing ourselves with the majesty and power and establishment that is his. And, you know, if we were to put it in the language of the Mosaic Psalms that we were talking about before, the ones from Moses, I mean, if we were to put it in that context, then it is, yeah, the mountains were established, the hills have been established, but you are eternal. You are the one who's established so much more firmly than they are. It would be that kind of contrast. If it is, instead, sort of a metaphor to say to us, you know, you look at the mountains and you see something that existed long before you and will exist long after you. That should cause you to look beyond the mountains to the God who existed long before you and will exist long after you. Or you could say existed long before the mountains and will exist long after the mountains. Either way, it's getting across this point of contrast with God's majesty and strength and permanence in contrast with us, at least. So in some ways, I'm going to use a poem to make this point, a poem I've shared with you before, so it won't be completely unfamiliar if you've been listening to other episodes that we've done, but the created order itself is obviously in contrast with our impermanence. We show up like pieces of dust on it. We blow around for a little bit, and we establish a few little contours, and then the wind blows, and we're gone, and the contours we left are gone. So the created order creates a contrast with our doings and our power, but the Lord's authority also creates that contrast. You know, we're nothing in comparison with the majesty and strength and permanence or power that's associated with Yahweh. And so in this first section of the psalm, we're definitely supposed to be in awe at the majesty, strength, and permanence of Yahweh, that is, at all the things we would associate with his power. And so I want to use, this poem that's written by Carl Sandburg called Statistics in the context of, you know, the looking back on the wake of World War I. He has these lines about Napoleon, who's dead and in his tomb, in his mausoleum, listening to all the things that are going on in the war that's happening now during the European conflicts in the early 20th century. And so at the end of the poem, what he comes to is this. He slept on, talking about Napoleon, because, you know, I mean, look, it's not hard to figure out where he's going to go with a poem like this. The metaphor is pretty profound, but it's also pretty obvious. You know, Napoleon's dead and in the ground, and Napoleon conquered the world, right? I mean, he conquered Europe. And so he's this great leader, this great empire builder, and nobody could be like Napoleon. But now he's in the ground, and all these other people are trying to conquer the same areas that he had conquered before. And what's really changed in all of that? And so the poem is expressing that in these lines. At the end of the poem, this is how it goes. Really, the whole poem's worth reading, again, called Statistics. And he slept on in the old sarcophagus while the aeroplanes, you get the context of the early 20th century, and he slept on in the old sarcophagus while the aeroplanes droned their motors between Napoleon's mausoleum and the cool night stars. Really beautiful close to a poem. The between, you know, Napoleon's mausoleum, so basically between the grave and the cool night stars, the heavens above, the cool night stars being, you know, it's a cool night, and obviously the description is of that, but the point is they're unmoving, they're fixed. They are the rigidity of the heavens, the eternal nature of the heavens. So you've got this grave below where Napoleon, who thought he was accomplishing great things, is already just in the ground, and then the stars above, which are fixed, this inherent image of fate or deterministic fixity, that there is nothing that's going to change at all, that kind of permanence in the cool night stars. The contrast is between the grave and the stars, the grave below, the stars above, all those who are dead below, all of the stars above, and then all this ant-like living activity that's on the ground. That's why the thing is called statistics. It's not called people, oh, the value of persons. It's statistics. These are just more numbers to go into the ground. And There are a couple of different takes. I mean, there are a lot of layers of beauty in that poem that are worth talking about. I just wanted to make this point to get back to the psalm and how the image that's given to us about creation and then about the permanence of God is a little ambiguous, but on purpose. It doesn't need to be resolved. We don't need to know how it means what it does. It inherently carries this message with it that strikes at our hearts, whether we want it to or not. So the two different metaphors in the poem that are possible are these. I mean, regarding this one image of between Napoleon's mausoleum and the cool night stars, that Napoleon's mausoleum would be the earth or the creation, the place where all these things come to be what they are in nature. And then the cool night stars would be the contrasting eternity, right? And in our minds, that is part of the image. Even though you and I know the stars move a tiny bit and it is measurable over time, it's measurable over a long time, a ridiculous amount of time, and they seem otherwise completely fixed. So our best metaphor for eternity in the created order are the stars. They are the thing that allows us to sense something of permanence. So it's possible to read this where you're saying that Napoleon's mausoleum is like the earth and creation in the psalm that we're looking at, and then the cool night stars would be the things that are everlasting. So the grave is this temporary reminder. I mean, it's awfully permanent. People die and they stay in the ground. But it's not as permanent as the stars are, which are like this thing that's everlasting. And both still make clear just how abbreviated the lives of human beings are and how abbreviated the impact of those humans is. So Earth and creation has one relationship through Napoleon's mausoleum and with us, and the cool night stars have a different relationship with us through that. The other way to take it is to be, and I'm using the poem because the poem has the same kind of ambiguity built into it, that Napoleon's mausoleum would be man's passé influence. Oh, great man, great ruler. Where is he now? Oh, yeah, well, he's just dirt. You know, that's just what he is now. Which dirt? It's all just dirt once it's dirt. In the contrast with that would be the permanence of either the earth and creation itself or the things that are even more permanent than that. And that would be sufficient, that the cool night stars would be this reminder that all of creation is still going to be here when man has come and gone. You know, that's just how it's going to be. That's in the poem I'm talking about. I understand the contrast between that and what we would say in the Judeo-Christian kind of tradition and in the understanding of Genesis's dominion, right? So anyway, you get the idea. I read you that section of the poem to make the point that in this opening to the psalm, the statement, the Lord reigns, he's robed in majesty, the Lord's robed and he's put on strength as his belt, we understand all of what he is automatically in contrast with what we are and with what the creation is. So when he starts the second half of that verse by saying, yes, the world is established, it shall never be moved, it could be as evidence of God's permanence. I mean, indeed, look how permanent God is. Even the creation he's made that we walk on every day has a sense of permanence to us. And that obviously leaves us recognizing, well, what David says in Psalm 8, what is man that you're mindful of him? And the reason David says it is in the light of this way of taking the metaphor, the way David says it is because of what he sees in the creation itself, not just looking directly at God, but looking at the creation. When I behold the heavens, when I see the work of your hands, I think to myself, what is man that you would even think about him? That's the one way to take this opening to the psalm. And the evidence of all of that would be the Lord and everything he's created is just so much more permanent than our passing breath. What is your life? James says it's a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. That's sort of the contrast that's built into us. Now, the focus isn't on diminishing us. The focus is on recognizing the permanence and majesty and strength, the power that goes with God. And that's what's going to make this interesting, because as he uses that particular metaphor, the creation has this tremendous power to it. And God has even greater power with him. As he uses that kind of imagery, we could just conclude that what he's going to say is, and, you know, that's the majesty we should worship. It's worthy of worship. But he doesn't end there in verse 5. He doesn't just focus on power. So it goes a slightly different direction. But the other thing, the other way of taking the metaphor, does seem to emerge more prominently starting in verse 3, in verses 3 and 4, because clearly there's a contrast between the floods being lifted up, which is another expression of the power of creation. When we see the power of the created order, the floods lifting up their voice, the floods roaring, then they can remind us of the power of God. And sometimes his voice is compared with the voice of many waters, right? That's how it's given to us. So we can understand that being a comparison. But in this case, it seems like he starts to make a contrast instead. Maybe he's just using it to inform the strength of God or the power of God so that we can give an expression to it that's meaningful. But in verse 3, the statement is, the floods have lifted up. So it's translated in the ESV as floods. It's waters, it's waves, it's, you know, whichever word you want to put on it, it's this movement of water. And you can imagine, I mean, a running rapids, you know, can have this roaring sound to it in the same way that waves crashing on the beach have this roaring sound to them. That's the level of sound that you have to be thinking of, whatever the image is you put on it. I think just based on the way it describes the waves of the sea and stuff, that we're supposed to see these as the waves that are crashing in some way. So the floods have lifted up, O Lord. The floods have lifted up their voice. The floods lift up their roaring. Now, again, the images are used so frequently, it's really hard to imagine a person picking up this song and not thinking of other songs they've sung, psalms that they've sung, that have similar imagery. It would be hard for somebody not to have it, especially ones that are as prominent as Psalm 46. So the language in Psalm 46 is about God being our strength and our place of refuge. It's a different purpose for the psalm. So I'm not going to say, well, this is the same thing as Psalm 46, but it has some of the same imagery. And so I want to create that contrast so we can make sense of what's happening in verse 5. So here in verse 3, the floods have lifted up their voice. They're lifting up their roaring. Listen to how Psalm 46 describes something similar. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. So now we start to think of, he hasn't mentioned the water yet, but he will. We start to think of whatever's coming as the indication of the contrast with God's persistent, present help for us. Oh, but there's trouble in the world. And how does he describe that in Psalm 46, verse 2? Therefore, we will not fear, even when the earth gives way. Remember, here we're saying, oh, the earth is established. Even though the mountains are moved into the heart of the sea, even though its waters roar and foam, even though the mountains tremble at the swelling of those waters. What we have in Psalm 46 in the first three verses is this use, and it does seem clear in Psalm 46 that this is the case, is this use of the waters and the way they're used throughout the rest of Scripture, which is as an image of the nations outside of Israel, and Israel is the land and the waters are roaring against it. And, you know, in their, and again, it's an immature way of thinking about God, but in their immature way of thinking about God, not Scripture, but the people of the ancient Middle East, Near East, you know, when they were thinking of God's authority, they thought of the places where they could see the order. And that would be where they're on land, for instance. And the waters were chaos and tumult and danger. It's why Jonah thinks he can run from the presence of God by going into the ocean. But there is no running from the presence of God in the ocean. We know that because he's over the oceans as well. But when they're hearing about the waters roaring, they're also hearing about the nations roaring against Israel. And so you expect the danger to come from the outside. And all of that is to be put in contrast with this mighty power of God, who is so much greater than the dangers that we sense in the world, that we can find our refuge in him. So you would almost expect a psalm to carry us there if it's going to be talking about the waters roaring, you know, and lifting up their voice. But that's not how this psalm carries it forward. Now, in the next verse, verse 4 of Psalm 93, where we are, in the next verse, after it says, the floods have lifted up, O Lord, the floods have lifted up their voice, the floods lift up their roaring, then we hear this description of something even mightier than that. And so it repeats the might of the storm, the might of the water, the roaring, the crashing of the waves, but it repeats it on the way to saying, God is even mightier, right? So by the time we get to the end of verse 4, we could have just said, oh, well, yeah, it's the same message that's in Psalm 46. You know, the nations are trouble. The world is trouble. The world does bring catastrophe, and the threats of it are pretty intimidating. But if we get in front of God, we'll realize he's a lot bigger than they are, and we don't have to worry about them. All of that is true and is present through verse 4, but I don't think it's the end to the story. So I want to pause on that part of the story, though, and make sure that we understand it. So the statement in verse 4 is, in Psalm 93, mightier than the thunders of many waters. So when we're repeating the statement about the thundering of the water, we're repeating it with an anticipation that something better is coming. Mightier than the thunders of many waters, mightier than the waves of the sea, the Lord on high, he's mighty. You think those are mighty? You ain't seen nothing yet, all right? That's the whole idea. So I'm only going to point this out because it is if you were in Israel in the first century or before, you sang these psalms and you knew these were references to Yahweh. And so you can imagine what this means in the boat in Israel on the Sea of Galilee when the waves are roaring and this man stands up in a boat and stops the waves, you know, just gives a word and stops the waves. I'll read it to you from Mark 4. On that day when evening had come, he said to them, let's go across the other side. And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat. They took him with them in the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat. So the boat was already filling, but he was in the stern asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, teacher, don't you care that we are perishing? The trouble has come. The waves are roaring. And he awoke and he rebuked the wind and said to the sea, peace, be still. And the wind ceased. And there was a great calm. And he said to them, why are you so afraid? You still have no faith? And they were filled with great fear and said one to another. I mean, now their fear is of something greater. They were afraid of the waves. Now they see him stop the waves. They're like, I was afraid of the wrong thing. What were we thinking here? Who then is this, they say, that even the wind and the sea obey him? That point, who is this? That's the point of that miracle. In their minds, it's a declaration that there's something divine going on with this person, because the descriptions of Yahweh are the descriptions that put him above the roaring of the sea. Okay, you get the idea. So now we have a perfectly complete psalm in 4 verses. We don't need verse 5. We should just get rid of it and keep this thing simple. But verse 5 does emerge, and it doesn't say, and so God's power is greater and he is our strength and refuge. It doesn't say that. It says, verse 5, your decrees are very trustworthy. Holiness befits your house, Yahweh, forevermore. This is the holiness, the trustworthiness of God, the decrees of God. Those are a different category of communication. They're affecting some completely different part of our being than the part of us that, you know, in our viscera responds with trembling in the presence of majesty and strength and even the permanence in contrast with our temporality. This is about God's decrees. Oh, yeah, and he's given us some commands. And his holiness, this is what he says he's like, that's different from you. And how he expects that to be manifest in us, where does that come from? And obviously in the psalm, we're supposed to read it and go, oh, well, it only makes sense that you wouldn't separate God's power from his purpose. He's not just randomly powerful. He's not just an elephant happening to trample on whatever ants get in his way. Not trying to be critical of elephants. I'm just saying, you know, who's trying to measure the ants they're stepping on? God's not like that. His power is not separable from his purpose. And I think the point of the psalm is, in us, it shouldn't be either. That is, separable from his purpose. We shouldn't think of God's power separately from thinking of his purpose. So let me give you an example in an application. This is a particular application, just one, but it's the way we distribute power in the world. So somebody in the world has power over society. They have political power, governmental power. Oh, wow, I guess they can do whatever they want to do. I mean, after all, they're the chosen of God. Whatever they do must be right. That's kind of how we hear Romans 13. We're missing the whole point. Listen to what Romans 13 says. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. So we'll talk about why we would be subordinate to the governing authorities in a moment. That's who he's speaking to, us, not to the governing authorities. He's speaking to us. So we're supposed to hear that. I'll come back to that in a minute. But what does he say about them? For there is no authority except from God. He is the power. If you have power in the world, it's because he's granted it to you. In the same way that if the mountains are established or if they have any kind of permanence in the world, it's because God chose to found them on something. If he hadn't, they wouldn't be, right? So the same thing with governing authorities. Those who exist, whatever authorities exist, they've been instituted by God, Paul goes on in Romans 13 to say. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed. Now, let's be clear here. This is written during a time where Christians are being persecuted by governing authorities, including Paul being persecuted by those governing authorities. But he goes on to say this in verse 3, for rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you'll receive his approval. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid. Pilate was in authority, and Jesus stood before Pilate and ended up crucified. If the authorities are always doing right, what on earth happened with Jesus, Paul? Isn't that what you want to ask? So he goes on to say this, but if you do wrong, be afraid. Jesus didn't do wrong, but he was crucified. But you'll notice he wasn't afraid. But anyway, he goes on to say, because the authority doesn't bear the sword in vain. He's the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. It's because of this, let's take it out of the hands of the sword and put it where the rest of us are. You know, you're going to pay your taxes or not. For because of this, you also pay taxes. For the authorities are ministers of God, attending to this very thing. Pay to all what is owed to them. Taxes to whom taxes are owed. Revenue to whom revenue is owed. Respect to whom respect is owed. Honor to whom honor is owed. It doesn't say your parents always deserve honor. It says you owe them honor. That's a completely different thing. So what's the point, of these first seven verses in Romans 13? Well, number one, and obviously this is stated explicitly, there's no authority except from God. All the power that does exist in the world exists in the world only because God has granted it. It wouldn't be there otherwise. So we're supposed to have that in mind. The second thing, and something we sort of ignore because it's not about this in this passage, is that God expects something of his subordinate authorities. He says it over and over again. God expects them to be the rewarders of good, the punishers of evil. He has put them in place so that they will do exactly that. Here's the thing. He doesn't say in this passage, and God will make it right with them. He will torture Pilate for what he did. He will rebuke Caesar for what he's doing. He doesn't do that because this letter isn't written to Caesar. This letter wasn't written to Pilate. It was written to us. It was written to people who are under those authorities. So God expects something of his subordinate authorities, but because we're not that authority, that governmental authority as recipients of this letter, remember, this letter is being written to Christians in a context of persecution, of disenfranchisement. Ooh, you're a Christian. You're not part of the authority that exists in our world. So that's not what the passage is going to be about. But the implications are obvious. That's what God expects them to do. He's God's servant for your good. He is the avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. He's the person who should reward good deeds. You say, yeah, but they're not doing that. So how can I obey them? Because God expects something of us also. And that's what is in the passage. Because it's written to us, the thing he expects from us is what's in the passage. And that is that our actions will demonstrate that we actually do trust him. That's why we submit to authorities. It's really just evidence that we trust not their use of authority, that we trust the one who is in authority over them. It's not, do you trust the government? It is, do you trust God? That doesn't mean the government's going to do the right thing. People are slaughtered all the time for wrong reasons. And who on earth would hold them accountable? That's the point. It's God. That's what our faith is supposed to declare. And again, this is in a book written in a century when Christians are being slaughtered for the entertainment of the people. So it's not like Paul is not aware that authorities abuse their power. The reality is, because God has authority over the authorities, because God is the permanence beyond what looks so permanent to us, that his authority, God's authority, results in our faith. Not our faith that the world's going to be good, our faith that God is in charge, our faith that God is the one who will make things right and that we can believe in. So he expects, this is the other thing he expects from us, he expects our faith to demonstrate that we believe in his power. We either do or don't believe in his power. He also expects our actions to demonstrate his holiness. I put actions, I could use the word obedience, but it's been so, sort of codified into this religious lingo that I don't think we think about what it means. So it results in our behavior being different, our actions, but it's our obedience. So it's faith and obedience, trust and obey, right? But he also expects our actions to demonstrate his holiness. Our faith demonstrates his power. Our actions demonstrate his holiness. Not just that he has power, but that he has a purpose in his power. That is, he expects our actions to be holy. He expects our actions to demonstrate that we're different from the regular order of the fallen world, like he's different from the regular order of the fallen world. He expects our actions to demonstrate that we love those who would be our enemies, that we die for those who would kill us, that we welcome those who would reject us, that we care for those who've only ever cared for themselves. And let me be specific. I'm not just making up some random list. I'm going through the holiness code. I'm going through the things that are described in Leviticus 19, the things that Jesus chooses to take up in the New Testament and say, this is what I meant by my expectation, that you would be holy as your Father is holy, that you would be like your Father in heaven, so that we would love those who would be our enemies, die for those who would kill us, welcome those who would reject us, and care for those who've only ever cared for themselves, just as he loved those who would be his enemies, and died for those who were killing him, who welcomed those who had rejected him, and who cared for those who had only before ever cared for themselves. The crux of this psalm, the thing that changes so much, is that this entire focus on power at the beginning turns not to change our minds about the power, it turns to build on that to say, but his power doesn't exist in a vacuum. He's just the biggest, strongest child on the block. His power exists in the context of his holiness and purpose. He's the one who can effect it and expects it to be realized in us because his holiness, his grace, his mercy, his love, extend as far as his power. And this is just such a theme throughout all of Scripture. Jonah is one of the best examples. It's the easiest one that I could always give you. You can go back and listen to the episodes that we did covering the book of Jonah. That whole book is about that. That's why all of the creation is described. It's why all the animals are present in the story. It's why he's going down into the depths of the sea. It's why he's going to Assyria, because God's grace is extended, his mercy is extended to the Ninevites, to the Assyrians, just as far as his power is extended. He is sovereign over them, and he is merciful toward them. Because his holiness, and in this psalm, by beginning with a description of his majesty and strength and permanence, but ending with a statement about his decrees and his holiness, so that we understand the thing about God that's eternal is not just his power, but his purpose. So because his holiness, his grace and mercy and love extend as far as his power, our holiness, our kindness and forgiveness and love should extend just as far as our faith in his power.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.